Right. I mean, it's the era of the lounge lizard with the pencil-thin moustache, possibly wearing some silk inner shoes.
Right.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I'm going to beg your forgiveness to read this, please, because when I read it, I thought, that's us.
What's
Who's
us?
Lurking outside?
Go on, do a bit of strong arm stuff.
It does smell.
It's a terrible smell in here.
What's she doing? It smells of school lunches.
Yeah,
you know that it's 11:45 in a corridor smell, isn't it? When you just think, what is it that they're either broiling or... it's not frying, is it? It's definitely a broil.
I was going to say, that's not the smell, surely.
Mariella's home. I think it'd be slightly more scented than
well, I
this.
Think it'd be lovely, Mariella's home. Probably it'll have one of those very posh candles on a long burn, won't it, Mariella's home?
I think Mariella would have one of those three-wick candles. I aspire to a three-wick candle.
Never owned a three-wick.
Yeah. Well, they're always, it's like the Body Shop large bottle, isn't it? You just can't.
It's a distant dream.
You can't quite make yourself do it. I read this morning, Jane, and, you know, sometimes you read something and you think, yeah, that's me and that's not good. And it was a piece by Martha Lane Fox, and it's about going to visit a really amazing project called Eye on the Code in a refugee camp called Kakuma in northern Kenya. And Eye on the Code teaches girls in the refugee camp how to code so that they have some skills for when life begins again on the outside, or for when life doesn't begin again on the outside. So it's a really amazing thing. But she says, I went to coincide with International Women's Day on March the 8th. It's easy to feel jaded about this event. Put your hand up when you think this is you and me. It can be a tyranny for already busy women who are asked to sit on a bunch of panels, go to a ton of events and push out affirmative messages about girl power on social media. Every year there is the inevitable hand-wringing and navel-gazing about its value, and some women flounce off to declaring it's not for them. Is your hand up yet? My hand's up because that's what we said, actually. And she goes on to say, well, to the women and girls of Kakuma, it does matter. This was a chance to feel heard and seen and part of something wider than the camp. It was moving Tyrrell the Pertry and witnessed the dance and the fashion shows. Strong, thoughtful, brave, brilliant, switched on girls powered by technology. I will try not to spend another Women's Day in a London office. And I just thought, yep, okay. So it was just worth pointing out.
Yeah. Okay. But I think it absolutely has a powerful message in parts of the world like that. But can we just actually also include this email from Elizabeth? After a long time in the workforce and over 20 years in HR roles, International Women's Day was wearing thin. All events, talks, workshops were preaching to the converted, which was what we were saying.
Yep.
Until this year, when I saw somebody called Caroline Fairberger speak. Hearing her experience of being a male CEO until she was 50 and then spending the last 6 years as a female CEO and her understanding of her privileges as a man was quite fantastic. However, the reason she was so good was that a huge number of our senior male leadership turned up. She opened their eyes because she'd been in their shoes.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
So that is really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So I just think you do need to just turn the dial a bit. And that's what we were saying. And I think just next year, we just have to make sure that we do something a little bit out of the building.
Well, let's. I mean, leaving the building would be amazing.
Would it?
I do go home.
But I don't like to leave the building during the working day. I just get that slightly naughty. Did you ever skive off from school?
No.
Okay, I used to skive off a lot in sixth form. And I'd drive my...
Well, sixth form's not quite the same, is it?
I'd cycle my red racing bike incredibly fast down the avenue in front of the trees so nobody could spot me going home at 11:45. And I think sometimes I did tell myself I'd come back for afternoon lessons. Of course, you never do. But I've got the same feeling. So I can't go out for lunch. I can't go out to get lunch because I think I won't come back.
What if you had a free period?
Oh, they're never free. No. What, you mean at work?
We kind of have a free period here before we start, don't we? This is effectively doing a podcast. It's a bit like a free period.
A free period.
We should start calling the show. Never mind off air, let's call it free period.
Couldn't leave the building.
Best thing about the sixth form, that the free periods. Wonderful. I remember trying to, because my parents left school at 16, so when I tried to kind of explain the concept of a free period, and the school was like, what? So you're not having lessons? No.
No, they were wonderful. I mean,
that was where all the real action was in the free periods. I was in the sixth form common room when Princess Di's engagement was announced. And I was thinking of that the other day when you were reading from Mr. Bates's memoir, because it was Simon Bates who announced it on Radio 1.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, in those dulcet, warm timbre tones.
Oh, yes. Well, he was very much a statesman, was Batesy. And actually, the song he played, totally inappropriate, actually, was John Lennon's Woman.
Oh, okay.
And then, in fact, I think he played it twice in succession because the news was of such import that he didn't really know where to go. He was blown off his DJ course by the phenomenal announcement.
Now, why did you think it particularly appropriate? What would have been a better record?
I don't know, something, Woman. I suppose Woman, I Can Hardly Express. What's the lyric of
My Inner Something and Thankfulness.
You're thankful, yeah. It's sort of a song you'd play when you're sort of 20 or 30 years into a relationship about a woman. And presumably he was singing about Yoko and that would make sense.
Yeah.
But... didn't seem... Anyway, look, I don't know why I'm questioning the music, the DJ choices. This is 1981. I need to be over this.
But imagine,
I should have moved on. I should have moved on.
Imagine the meeting that they would have had in the run-up to the possibility of that announcement being made.
As to
what tune would be played the time. Because anyway, they do. They angst over things like that.
Well, yeah. Do you remember the banned music during the Iraq War?
Yeah, there was a whole
BBC list. Banned a whole list of songs which we couldn't play. That's when I think we were both music DJs in our younger day. Linda says, I'm a little reluctant to recommend this showbiz memoir as I am actually a huge fan of this man. However, his literary musings should not be kept from you. Have either of you read Michael Flatley's autobiography?
No, but I'm going to now.
Yeah, he is the king of Riverdance. Linda says, it's just spectacularly awful. Sorry, but it is. Okay. It will give you many hours of entertainment.
Well, you order that.
Okay, I will.
And if it's okay with you, I'm going to go off piece. I'm not going to do Michael Parkinson. I'm just going to do a little bit from David Niven because it is quite something.
David Niven? Crikey.
It's really, really... So he became as well known for his books, because I think there are quite a few volumes of his autobiography.
It was The Moons of Balloons.
Yes, yeah, exactly that, about the nature of fame. And they were hugely successful. Mm. And then he did actually write his own novel off the back of it too. So I've been chortling away at home over some of the descriptions of life in the 1950s
and 60s. A male chauvinist pig?
No, do you know what? He does write very well and self-deprecatingly, and it is very funny, but it is just a different era. I mean, it's the era of the lounge lizard with the pencil-thin moustache, possibly wearing some silk inner shoes.
Right.
Under its slip-ons.
So it's Leslie Phillips with knobs on.
It is that kind of, you know, I just imagine these men who are kind of gliding through life, just gliding through.
Just be a fine thing.
So I also thought that we should spend just a tiny bit more time talking about American Riviera Orchard, because I don't think we've given it the full welly yet, and I think that our listeners might have some things to contribute. American Riviera Orchard is the, as you said yesterday, word soup that's been created by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex.
And Harry.
It's a merchandising opportunity, and it's going to come out of Montecito. And what kind of things will we be able to buy from American... I've written it down because I just can't remember it.
I can't remember it. It doesn't stick, does it? I think it's products like nut butter and yoga mats, and I'm guessing, well, tablecloths, special napkins. Who doesn't love a cloth, a proper napkin?
I love a proper napkin.
And it sets mealtimes alight, doesn't it? Mm. When you sit down with a proper napkin.
Do you think that they'll do those tea towels that you can buy in National Trust properties that list the genealogy of the kings of England?
Probably not those. Okay. There's something very funny about tea towels because they can be incredibly pompous.
Oh, but also they can be incredibly informative.
And also educational. Yeah. But when you consider what they're actually for, it's a bit rogue.
But I think the tea towel with informative things on it is a thing of the past, actually. Mum had one that had the kings and queens of England, and I swear to God, I learnt more from that because it just hung, you know, in the kitchen in front of the cooker than I ever did in the history lessons.
I'm a real sucker for a fridge magnet, and everywhere I go, every place I visit, I get a fridge magnet. And I was at Tate Britain on the weekend, and I bought 4 fridge magnets there because I think they were 4 for a tenner or something. Really good value. I mean, that is really good value, isn't it?
It is.
I'm
casting deep into my retail experience knowledge of fridge magnets.
So I've got several artworks in fridge magnet form.
Okay. Well, that's very good.
Isn't it? And they just, you know, you're pinning something to your fridge and, you know, it's lovely.
Yeah. My favourite one's an espadrille bought in Menorca.
Well, you got
Menorca.
You've got me some. Yeah, I've still got the pair.
Yeah.
In fact, you splashed out, you got me two.
But look, I think we could have some fun if we were going to do our own equivalent. So, what would ours be? American, it would be British.
Yeah.
Riviera.
British.
Seaside stroll. Burnt out pier.
Blackpool Pier. Burnham-on-Sea. Oh, God, this is where it gets slightly difficult. British.
What's our
seaside
equivalent?
Well, it'd have to be seaside. British seaside.
Orchard. Allotment. Backyard.
British seaside garden?
British seaside garden. Yeah. So what are the things that we're going to sell out of British seaside garden? I think it's more likely to be mini golf, isn't it?
Yeah,
Riviera is a mini golf.
It just hasn't taken off this for me.
British mini golf. What was it? Garden. Yeah.
British mini golf garden. Okay. Yeah. No, this needs more work.
It does. Well, our listeners will furnish us with a list of merchandise that they'd like us to sell at British Mini Golf Garden.
By the way, I mean, this is actually a serious opportunity for us. So if you can think of any products that you would buy...
Because we are actually...
We're moving into the world of merchandising.
We are,
I mean, you're laughing at Harry and Meghan, but seriously, we're coming at you. Look out, Montecito. I can't ever pronounce that either. How is it pronounced?
Montecito.
Yeah. We're possibly...
I think we've got as far as a tote bag, didn't we?
Well, yes,
we've got to have more than a tote bag.
Yeah. We've got to get on with this. Yes. This is actually a podcast. And we were talking seriously yesterday about funerals and about what it's like to speak at a funeral. And thank you so much for your very touching and, can I say, nuanced responses to this. And I think this is a really interesting experience from a listener. We don't need to mention her name. Last year, my ex-husband died by suicide. Now, that must have been terrible, by the way, and I'm so sorry. I hadn't spoken to him for many, many years, and he was distanced from our 3 adult children. He also had another child from his second marriage. Now, as it turned out, none of them felt they could stand up and speak, and I did understand this. As it was a family-only event, his funeral, I was the only person who could manage it. His sibling was no longer alive. So I wrote the first part of his eulogy, and the adult child from his second marriage wrote the second part. It was a challenge to not mention myself or his second ex-wife, she didn't attend, but just to focus on the most positive facts of his life. It was a strange experience and not something I did very well at all, none of us being good at public speaking. Well, we don't know whether you did it well, but the fact that you did it at all is incredibly commendable. She goes on to say, but at least it was something. And we were able to put together an excellent slideshow with great music, which I feel made it more tolerable. I was acutely embarrassed to find out afterwards that the funeral had been videoed and many people watched it in real time in the remote country town in which he lived. I'm Australian, and I can assure you that lots of people still say koala bear. OK, well, that was... Thank you for that. But I really admire you for speaking at that event. That must have been exceptionally difficult. And but how wonderful that you did do it and that you were able to put all the right stuff in, because that will have been quite a task, I suspect. But really brilliant that you did it.
Very much so. I think I brought the wrong pile of emails in with me, Jane. And then it would be a mistake, having said that, to start reading out stuff from the wrong part of emails, because that would seem a little bit rude to people who are in,
right. Who are in the right pile.
There's no wrong pile.
Well, there is.
Right pile. But there's just a pile that we might not get to today. So well, have you got another one there?
I have, because we have had some really interesting ones on this subject. This is from Pauline, again in Australia. Jane and Fee, I've spoken at 8 funerals. My parents, several friends, old teachers. It is obviously a difficult thing to do, and yet one always wants to remain self-possessed in order to do justice to the loved one. The best advice anyone ever gave me was to speak the eulogy out loud multiple times before trying to deliver it. You need to get yourself to the position where you are so thoroughly familiar with the text that you don't upset yourself in the delivery. And I think that's excellent advice.
Yeah.
Because I do think if you are doing the eulogy, one would totally sympathise with somebody who broke down. But in the end, it's not about you, is it? And that's it's a tough lesson for me, let me tell you. But it really isn't. And I've got to sort of confess, I did do a eulogy for a very good friend of mine some years ago. And I was very young when I did it, because he died very, very young. I got it wrong, actually, I now realise. I think I spoke in a way that paid tribute to his professional talents, but didn't really... I couldn't have encompassed what he meant to his mum, for example, because I wasn't even a parent at the time. I don't know. I've often thought about that and thought, oh, God, if I got the opportunity to do that again, I'd do it much better.
But also, I think, Jane, it just doesn't matter if you do break down. You know, it is one of those occasions where people's expectations, I think, are really normal. They're not, they're not looking to you to take them somewhere remarkable or to be ultimately professional. They know that it's probably not your normal job and you're outside of your own emotional comfort zone too. So I think it probably helps just to realise that it would be okay if you didn't make it through to the end. And I've been to funerals where somebody else has to pick up the
Yeah, it's always good to have somebody standing
by,
isn't it?
Very much so. Yeah, yep, totally, totally. This one, and thank you, Eve, because Eve popped out to get the pile that I'd earmarked stuff from. This is a ticking off from Mift in Hampshire. I love the show. I've been a faithful listener to you from day one. Once again, though, you've not announced the book club book on the day promised. Why? It's very annoying. Sending a big tut with a huge emoji eye roll. I still love you both, though. That's the kind of love that we like. It's unconditional and forgiving. Right, we are going to be reading A Dutiful Boy by... Oh, look, we're on film.
It's called A Dutiful Boy, as my colleague points out, and it's by Mohsin Zaidi. And it is in paperback now. It's autobiographical. It's a memoir of secrets, lies and family love. That's the subtitle. It's about a British man who is growing up in a devout Muslim household. And he's gay and it's exceptionally difficult. But he triumphs ultimately, becomes the first person from his school to go to Oxford. So a colossal achievement there. And it's been much praised. Lots of people say this is excellent, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Who was the chooser? Who was the recommender? We'll get back to you on that. Don't worry, we'll get back to you on that. So we divided all of the recommendations into four. And we took them all home with us and read them through. So please, if you sent in a recommendation, it was suitably pored over, and we've chosen this because
it's a British experience, it's a gay male experience, it's a Muslim experience. It just certainly takes me somewhere else. And we wanted to do something that was rooted in Britain that wasn't fiction, because I don't think we've done a single book set in Britain to this point.
Not
so
yet.
We thought we'd just have a little touch of home.
Lovely. Yeah. So it's not a huge book, is it?
No, it's not. That's another part of its appeal.
It
obviously
is 273 pages long. It's nicely spaced. I'd say that's probably on 1.5 and the font is about 11. So it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. It's not like one of those Dickensian tomes, which is packed in, kind of 0.5. And we'll read it, we'll do it in 6 weeks' time?
Oh, yes. I think I could manage it in six
Something
weeks.
Something like that. Yeah. Thank you also for all your fantastic television recommendations. Jill is the second person to recommend Under the Banner of Heaven for immediate viewing, says Jill. might leave now. It's on ITVX, but also Disney Plus, stars Andrew Garfield, based on a true story concerning a murder in the Mormon community. I understand it was written by Tom Daly's husband, who was brought up in the Mormon community. Gripping, says Jill. So, yeah, I might give that a go. And I started The Gone last
night. Oh, did you? Yes. Okay.
On BBC Four.
Yeah.
Woof.
Yes, I think it's good.
Yeah.
And I've, do you know, I don't think I've ever watched a show set in New Zealand. Ever.
Was it the Loch one was set in New Zealand? The really terrifying adaptation. I'll get round to it. I'll have a look. Beautiful backdrop.
Yeah.
Obviously, slight kind of Irish gangland subplot. All good so far, Jane. Mm, all good.
And one of the characters has the surname...
What?
Garvey. Right. That's why I like it.
Do you ever wonder about the solipsistic journey through life?
I don't. Although, funny enough, I couldn't watch Bad Sisters, which was the Apple show with Sharon Horgan, because they played the Garvey sisters. I didn't like that.
Because they weren't nice.
They weren't very nice. They weren't very nice to each other. Right. This is about boarding school. And it's interesting because people, I think if you've been to boarding school and you had a pretty good experience, you're quite defensive about the whole subject of boarding schools, aren't
you? And so you should be.
And I guess you would be.
Yeah. Because you would want to hear somebody dissing your childhood who actually doesn't have the experience that you've had.
This is from, Fiona. I went at 5 years of age. I mean, that is so young. As did my older brother. It was the 60s, she says. My father was a planter in Malaysia and we lived remotely on plantations. A school was established in the country to accommodate expat children of planters and tin mining and other expats, so children would not need to go overseas until they were older at, say, 10. It was still a plane ride, a bus journey, a funicular railway ride, followed by a walk to the school, which is on top of Penang Hill. I mean, that does sound, it sounds so impossibly exotic. It was difficult at times, but we were all in the same boat and we just got on with it. I remember the first nights back at school, hearing all the muffled crying into the pillows after lights out. I remember a particular teacher, a Mrs. Ong, who would throw chalk and blackboard dusters at our heads if we weren't concentrating. She would also hang children upside down by their ankles, though I can't remember why. It wasn't for fun, though. I do remember the drama of one very irate dad supposedly turning up to the school to confront the teacher. It must have been a rumour, because frankly, she continued to teach there. After the evening meal, we'd say the Lord's Prayer, sing a hymn, and hope our name would be read out to collect a letter from home. When I was then sent to boarding school in Scotland at 10, I was an old pro at boarding. I did find it a cultural shock, though. Cold and my uniform was itchy. I did find myself, at the age of 11, pinned up against a wall by my throat by an irate teacher and was routinely humiliated in class, having to stand on desks and cupboards. The teacher did end up in jail years later. I mean, you know, this stuff did go on, didn't it? My husband still says I'm a cold fish at times. He went to boarding school too, but he didn't go until he was 10, and he's got some stories as well. I think... Yeah, Fiona's experience is, I mean, I have to say that's probably more typical of that era, and one would really sincerely hope that they are not, they're not such extreme experiences now. But we have had quite a few emails from people saying, look, I went and it actually was great.
Yeah, and I think apart from anything else, I think there's better vetting of teachers. But also there's a lot of flexi-boarding in boarding schools now, where you go, you know, you can choose how many nights you're going to stay, and presumably that means that your parents live relatively close, you know, certainly not a plane and a train and a funicular ride away.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't feel quite so estranged from the rest of the world, would you? But I think also it's not our right or job to condemn other people for their parents' choices. I mean, you know.
No, I think our correspondent there, you revisit some of your parents' decisions, don't you? And we know when we become parents ourselves that we're likely to be making potentially impactful life choices on behalf of our own children almost from the minute they're born. So, you know, and you're not going to be perfect.
No. And so, I wonder how many you know, parents who didn't go to boarding school then decide that it's a great place for their kids to go? Because the assumption always is, isn't there? You've been to boarding school, it's been a terrible experience. You definitely make the choice never to send your kids. But the boarding schools of Britain presumably are quite full. So somebody is making the choice to go.
I think a lot of people had a terrible time at boarding school and then sent their children to boarding school. I think that appears to be quite a small
area of judgment and condemnation there.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but you can't blame your kids for what your parents choose.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This one comes from Pamela Wade, your worn-out correspondent who's finding the admin of teaching just too wearying should know, and I understand why, that there are more ex-teachers out there than any other profession. I didn't know that. From Sting, he always rears his head somewhere, doesn't he? To Alexander Graham Bell, there's absolutely no limit to what teachers can turn their hands to and succeed at, thanks to the demands and incidental training of that job. Pamela includes herself in that cohort and says, I'm very glad I made the jump. It changed and enriched my life immensely, even if travel writing is much more of a lifestyle than a living. And Pamela is an award-winning freelance travel writer. She's been doing that since 2009. Guest on the programme today used to be a teacher.
What about that for a link? Jeff Norcott is with us. He has just made a documentary. It's on the BBC iPlayer now. It's called Is University Really Worth It? It was broadcast on BBC Two last week. You may have caught it then, but you've still got every chance to see it. Let's just have a quick listen.
And when I went to uni, it was a time to explore choices, you know, make mistakes, have fun. And now, proud dad myself, I've started thinking about what uni might be like for Jeff Jr. And from what I'm hearing, things ain't great.
Lecturers have been striking, and 69% of graduates feel their degree wasn't even worth it.
So I should be putting away a bit of money now so that Jeff Jr. can follow in my footsteps, but I also need a new motor. So I'm going to hit the road to find out where my money's best spent and start doing some research.
He's got an English degree from Goldsmiths at London University, has Jeff. That's correct, isn't it? Yeah. Got 2-1.
2-1. Very incongruous place for me to go, Goldsmiths.
It's in Deptford, isn't it?
It's in Deptford, but it's very trendy and right on. And
it's very artistic, Jeff.
Very artistic. I mean, they were... I went in the mid-90s during the Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, Blur thing. And a lot of people went there because it was like a destination place. I went there because I could commute. And I looked on the map, I went, where can I get to from Mitcham and get home again? But that's what happens when you're the first in your family to go to university. You think, right, where can I get to by bus?
Yeah, and that's exactly what you did. But you are probably the only right-wing comedian to have gone to Goldsmiths, I would imagine.
I'm not sure that I figure higher in their alumni. They probably keep that quiet. Yeah. And fair play, if I was them, I'd go Blur, Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst as well.
Not so much Jeff Norcott. Right.
Can I just ask if your son is called Jeff Jr.?
He's not. I was going to clarify that as well. Well, so the thing was, my dad was called Jeff Norcott as well. And I obviously thought, well, that's a ridiculous thing to do it a third time. But then as a comic, I'm going, rule of three. Mm. That's kind of, it's funny again once you do it a third time.
It is.
But my wife, she didn't think that she thought that was a joke that would be funny once.
Rather than for a lifetime.
Rather than for a lifetime.
Okay, so it's not Jeff. Phew, I was worrying about that as well. So we know that it's some way off your son's potential university career, and the idea of the programme is that you travel the length and breadth of the land. Mm. I've got to say, and as Fee identified earlier, a really dirty car.
Dirty? I mean, lived in is another way of looking at it.
You've got a lot of crumbs in that bit around the gear stick, you know, with all the flabby fabric and stuff.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that's called, the gear sleeve, perhaps, but that was commented upon. That was the thing that grossed people out the most. I mean, I would say that as a touring comic, I've been on tour since forever, but that's the office, right? I'm in there every day. I'm spending like up to 6 hours a day in there, but it's unforgivable. I mean, there's no defence to how bad it looked. But yeah, I mean, you're right in saying that my son is still relatively young, but I'm very on it about saving. So we thought... we need a 10-year saving plan. And then I realised basically that I'd always presumed that once I went to university, that would then be a thing in our family. But I sort of realised that given the noises coming out of the sector and stuff, that I'd become like quite highly sceptical.
Well, what was the situation when you went? Did you get a grant?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I got obviously tuition fees were paid and I was one of the last ones to get a grant. It wasn't loads, but like it was a couple of grand or something. So,
right.
So yeah, I mean, now you realise what a privileged position that was to be in.
So I don't think it was the same for our generation. I don't think we thought about it very much. I was the first person in my family to go and it was considered to be a bit of an achievement. And certainly nobody questioned. Well, there wasn't a financial outlay. I mean, I got by. It wasn't a great existence, but it was more than bearable.
Well, it was seen to be postponing work in some ways, wasn't it? Going like my dad was very, very dubious about the whole thing. I mean, he wasn't even sure that I should have done A-levels. He was like, oh, 3 more years, what are you playing at? And then look, I've just realised in saying that, I've sort of become my dad going, you know, get out, get a trade. Yeah. But I do think materially the workplace has changed. And I think that when you look at what people could earn in trades, you know, I use the example of plumbers in the film. Mm. And it's not just me. But I don't obviously think that every single person should become a plumber. But also, I've never known a plumber that wasn't as busy as they wanted to be. And you do look at the march of AI and you sort of think, well, what are things that a computer could never do? And I think there's an actually sound logical reason that a computer could never do plumbing.
Well, you need to future-proof your earnings, don't you? And plumbing is one. I think hairdressing is another. Let's not get onto the gender differences, but of course, hairdressing, usually, they're not always done by women, not as paid as well.
Well, one of
as
your
plumbing,
ex-students who you meet
men.
In the documentary is running a barbershop and actually doing much better than his wife, who went to university and got a degree and is now a teacher. So hair works.
Hair does work. I mean, it's the only thing left on the high street. That's the only thing you go there for, is a haircut or a coffee. Mm. So it seems, I was going to say growth area, but you'd have thought it was a bad joke, but it honestly wasn't.
Ooh, we'll let
hair,
it pass.
Hair is a growth area. But I did go and meet those students, and that was one of the most perilous moments because they kept it from me as to who the students were. And I was part, you know, I was a teacher in the Blair years and fully promoting the old education. Everyone's got
to You went back to the school where you taught.
I did go back to the school where I taught. And so I didn't know how it panned out for them. And actually, it hadn't panned out fantastically. You know, there was a cross-section of four of them. And a couple of them, you know, people seeing the film actually felt that they'd sort of been press-ganged a bit into it, as though there was no other option. Now, I remember being a teacher around that time, and it was an orthodoxy almost. It was, we've got to get our numbers up. You know, the percentage of students going into higher education is part of how a school sells itself in the area. Now, it's still like a noble thing to want to get kids to uni. I'm not like dumping on the industry completely, but I just wonder if it's a time where we sort of reflect on how tempered that message needs to be based on the students, based on their skill set.
And the cost of it, I mean, the basics are your student loan for your tuition is 9,250 quid a year, for which you might get about 7 or 8 hours teaching a week, depending on what the course is. Mm. It's the same, though, if you're doing mechanical engineering, when presumably you get a load more teaching and a lot more, many more hours spent in labs, for example. Yeah. Aren't the people doing arts and social sciences degrees subsidising those doing more practical, frankly, slightly harder degrees?
Yes, I mean, well, that might be the way that they see it. And the problem is there were some startling stats to come out of the research that we did. And one of them was that a male who does creative arts or some sort of creative degree, it will earn less than if they went straight to work from school. I mean, maybe it's not that surprising when I say it out loud, but I suppose the reason it interested me was that we're often told, well, graduates will have higher lifetime earnings.
And our generation, that's true.
It's true, and it's still true, but to an extent, but that is a very blunt instrument of a stat. If you actually start digging down into it, it very much divides on what course you did, where you did it. You know, red brick still has a massive premium, whether it was related to a vocation like medicine or being a vet or so on. And then, you know, once you get into the humanities, not so much. But then the problem is like, I think emotionally, do I really want to be suggesting that no one should do the humanities? Absolutely not. Yeah. I did English and I love it, but the costs are exponentially higher. And you mentioned the tuition fees, and another thing that sort of goes under the radar a bit is that the loan hasn't actually gone up been upgraded with inflation. So while pensions and benefits have all been upgraded with inflation, the loans haven't. So rents have gone up and they can't even borrow to keep up with that.
Well, I mean, my youngest daughter is still at university. Mm. And I think it does seem to me, based on the experience of her and some of her cohort, that it's a very different experience for those kids who, as with everything, have come from slightly more privileged backgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
Because they've got so much financial help from home. Mm. And then you've got kids who are putting themselves through university and having to pay their rent using the quite puny maintenance grant, which you can apply for alongside the student loan. It seems to be, I mean, I've just looked it up. If you, the maximum maintenance loan you can get if you're outside London and if your family household income is less than 25 grand, the maximum a student gets is 10 grand, 227 quid. Now, you have to properly eke out an existence on that. And some people are doing that for most of the year.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, one of the people in the documentary that most people wanted to talk to me about was Malia, who's studying medicine. And it should be said that her situation is slightly aggravated by the fact she's estranged from her parents. But that's no guarantee that they're going to send food parcels or money every week.
They might not be able to.
And she literally wasn't. I mean, I was talking to her and I was trying to get, you know, into the reads of what her life's like, and ended up asking the question, are you actually getting enough calories on a day in, day out basis? It really came down to that, you know, people working extra jobs. And at a time when we feel like we need more doctors, like what she's going through to get to that, it just felt hard. It felt really hard.
We were talking about this on air before, and we've talked about it in the podcast too. She's only on year two of her medical degree as well, so she's got a lot coming at her already. And she just looked really quite unwell. She looked tired and fed up. I mean, our hearts absolutely went out to her. But do you think that the universities are doing enough, aside from the finances, to make sure that students like that are okay?
Well, I mean, the duty of care did come into it. And, you know, there were some good examples. But one thing that came out was the COVID experience and how students were treated during that. I mean, you spoke about face-to-face learning. It's a lot of universities were very slow to go back to face-to-face learning. You know, we're lagging way behind the rest of society. Some of them actually took on more students during that time because obviously you could do webinars and so on. And it's just not the same, is it? I mean, if you're sitting there, what you imagine the uni life to be is not really the chat area of a Zoom, is it? You know, just sort of waving at each other while an international lecturer is doing a lecture on his sofa.
That must have been an absolutely miserable experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, Tia, who's in the documentary, you know, she wanted to study art, and, you know, that's a very tactile experience. And she is part of, like, a big class action that is now happening with a law firm, which I think has already got 150,000 people. And I think they've got a legitimate case. If I was the unis, I would literally be going, right, we saw what happened with PPI. Let's get ahead of this. Let's offer every student that went to college during that period a few hundred quid, and let's head it off at the pass. Because I mean, I don't know how far I can go in saying it, but I think that there's an interesting case to be had there.
Yeah, well, what is the right system? Because Fi and I have been talking about this today, and when we went to university, the taxpayer, vast majority of whom had no hope or expectation of going to university themselves, were paying for the likes of us to do arts degrees. Mm. Now, was that any fairer than the current situation we have right now?
This is what I find difficult, is because broadly speaking, I do agree with the principle of people paying for their own education. But you just wonder if it's the amount of people that are going. Like the universities, they're, you know, in the early 60s, 4% of people were doing degrees. Now it's 40%. But we're also told that it's, the industry is creaking. They can't afford it. And on a basic level, you think, well, there's loads more people doing a thing. They're all paying $9,000 a pop. You know, you've got international students. What is wrong with this sector? Has it become bloated? And there are some universities that have just indulged in what, frankly, look like vanity projects. You know, these huge buildings, these bridges, and there are quite a few, not all. I mean, I think 2/3 aren't running at a surplus, but about a third are. And some of the big ones have got some fairly massive war chests, and which seems a bit gross, actually, when you consider, you know, what modern students are facing.
You did meet some very happy people who had not gone to university, didn't you? Including the fantastic plumber who'd just come back from Turkey with his new teeth.
Well, this is the thing. People say, why can't you get a decent plumber? Because they're on holiday, like, every third or fourth week. They seem to be going to Turkey, just living wonderful lives. And why not? It's like a really hard, specialised job. But it did feel like there was a weird point in the noughties where we just sort of forgot how important and brilliant those jobs were. And so part of this film maybe is not to say that universities are terrible thing. It's a rebalancing process in the way that we discussed those options. And the vice chancellor thing, some of the pay that they get, they would make the argument that it's worth it in terms of what it brings in. But there was one vice chancellor whose package was worth like $750,000
well,
a year.
Well, that is the woman in charge of Imperial, which is a hugely important and well respected global institution in London, isn't it?
£750,000 though.
Well, it's a lot of money. Yeah. I mean, it is a lot of money. Nat has texted to say, I'd like Jeff to do another show about how it feels to be a lecturer in one of these institutions. You can't grade students fairly anymore. You're pressured. In fact, somebody talked to you about that, didn't they?
Yeah.
You're pressured into doing extra pastoral work for little pay because the students are clients now. And reviews and TikToks about how enjoyable their experience is far more important than your old school teaching.
Well, the grade inflation thing is a really important aspect of it. You know, between 2010 and 2020, the amount of firsts being awarded doubled. Now, you might say kids work hard now. They do. You know, they're bright, they're focused. I don't think anyone can credit the amount of people that are capable of getting a first has doubled in that time. So you think, well, what else is it? I guess that they are sort of clients. They're able to say, if you give them a 2-1 or a 2-2 and they felt they deserved better, they can say, well, I've got $9,000 on the table that says otherwise. That was completely different. I wouldn't have dreamed of challenging a grade. But no wonder, if you're taking on $15,000-$20,000 worth of debt a year, of course you're going to challenge it. And since the film's gone out, I've had lots of people contacting me privately. I would say that the issue of grade inflation is perhaps worse than I suspected. People are being lent on to say, you can't fail these people. And someone that reached out to me, and like I say, I haven't got full verification for this, but when it came to international students, the pressure was even greater not to fail them.
Right, OK, because they really are paying a lot of money, aren't they?
Three times, yeah.
Yeah. So here you sit. Well, what's the date today? It's the 19th of March. The election, well, we thought it might be May the 2nd. Now they're talking about June, possibly. What's your best guess, Jeff?
Well, I saw something saying October the 17th. I think maybe this is what we'll just do for the rest of the year. We'll just say, where's Kate and when will the election be?
Okay.
And they will be, and these will be eternal questions. Look, it's great for content, isn't it? You know, if you're in the political...
Well, if Kate could stand for election, I think we'd have the ultimate content.
Okay, well, the dream ticket would, of course, be Kate and Martin Lewis. For some reason, the British public wish to be governed, I think, in a sort of benevolent dictatorship run by Martin Lewis. I think he's a nice enough guy. I don't know if he's proved enough for me that he could handle all these sort of offices of state. But he often says, you know, do balance transfers, switch to a lower energy provider. And that feels like enough for a lot of the British public.
He's very energetic, isn't he?
Very energetic.
Whenever I see him, I just think, whatever he's on, I'd like just a quarter of it. What? And I would function quite well.
If you were a Tory party strategist, which I know you're not, would you advise them to change leader now?
I think they would look legitimately insane if they did that. It just feels like there's no good way for them. I think one of the big mistakes that they've made is that if Sunak had come in, right, everyone's like, you're the steady guys, you're the boring men in suits, you and Hunt. It's like when a football club goes into administration. I would have said, right, just don't mind us. We're going to sort this out. It's going to be really boring. We're not going to do anything flash. But in about a year, we'll get back to you and we'll let you know some of the stuff that we've done. But they've done these absurd number of rebrands, which I think when the public start to think, well, if you don't know who you are, how can I know who you are? So you know what? I love content. Another leadership contest. I've changed my mind. Another leadership contest.
Bring it on.
Let's do it. It's always good. Look, I'm in political comedy, so a Tory leadership contest is like Harvest Festival.
I know you attract an audience of people who are not necessarily Conservative supporters or even particularly right-wing, but do you encounter any enthusiasm for the Conservative Party as you go about your comedic business?
Well, this is the weird thing, isn't it? Because, like, the people on the right are fed up with them. As well. So what you find now, comedically, it's actually... A lot of people said, oh, it's a boom time during the Boris years and the Corbyn years. Actually, people were so tribally entrenched then, it was hard to do comedy that didn't sort of overly annoy one group of those people. But now, everyone's annoyed. So it's the best time I can remember to do political comedy, and that's one of the ironies about this job, is the worst things are, the better it is for comedy.
Yeah, and for news radio, in fairness. That was Jeff Norcott musing on university and whether or not it's the right path. It isn't for everybody, but it is for many, isn't it, Fee?
Did you ever look back and think, what a waste of time, I shouldn't have done that?
I think I wasted my time at university, but that's not the fault of the institution, that's my fault. And I didn't make the most of it.
And if you'd had to saddle yourself with debt, would you have gone?
Really good question, because my
my dad was out of work when I went to university. I'm not sure we... I think my parents... That's a really good question. I don't know what the answer would have been. So 1982, Liverpool. Would my parents have been able... Would they have believed that it was a good thing for me to go to university and be, quotes, saddled with debt? And I know there are all kinds of interpretations of the student loan. And I know Martin Lewis, for example, the money-saving expert, says you shouldn't think of it as debt, blah, blah, blah. You can think of it, I get all that. But I, and I'm not demeaning him at all, but I do wonder what my parents would have thought about that, because they're quite risk-averse still. And I'm not sure that I would have gone. It's interesting. Don't know. Really don't know. I mean... I'm really troubled by the fact that the young woman that Jeff meets in the documentary, who's a medical student, who doesn't have support from her own family, and we don't know why, but she doesn't. I thought her eking out an existence, or barely any decent food, was diabolical.
So she was the one who was having to shop for 2 weeks on 20 quid.
It's ridiculous.
And she was a second-year medical student. Yeah. She looked exhausted already.
She will, and wait till she actually gets to be doing hospital. This is preposterous.
Yeah.
So why do we not... cut some slack to people studying subjects that are vitally important?
Yeah.
I guess the debate there would be, well, where do you draw the line? Does a biochemist get a free pass but not someone who's doing geography?
I think the conclusion I came to after watching it, Jane, was that something does have to change. I mean, it really does. So whatever it was that the government thought was going to be beneficial by introducing student loans and making students pay fees themselves has not come to fruition. Whatever it was that was on their piece of paper that said this is the way forward, it's going to save the country and the treasury money, but it's not going to harm education. It's wrong. It's just not worked.
I find this a debate. I never know what the answer is. So when I went to university in 1982, it was on, I got... everything was free. I think this is right. Everything was free. Although I'd been to a private school. So I went from a private school to a state-sponsored university education where I did almost no work because I was a lazy moo. And people with no opportunity to even dream of going to university were subsidising me not reading The Mill on the Floss in Birmingham. Now, what's fair about that? Nothing. So... I don't know. I don't know what, genuinely don't know how we fund. What is the fairest way to do this?
Yeah, I did like the points that Jeff made about, because I think our generation still
hardly anybody went to university in those days, by the way.
It was 4%, wasn't it?
Tiny.
And it's now 40%.
Yeah.
I think our generation sees universities as these, kind of slightly removed halls of excellence and education. Mm. And, you know, the current generation knows that they're a business. And so the point that he continually makes about the fact that the customers and the clients involved in a business are just, you know, they are entitled to a refund. They are entitled to say, this bit's not working, that bit's not working. And that's a whole different mindset, isn't it? So that just can't carry on. I mean, so there was loads and loads and loads, I thought, in his documentary.
Well, the pay of university vice chancellors.
I didn't know that.
It's £500,000.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah.
In some cases.
Yeah, well, I don't think any of them are doing badly.
Yeah. I did think his car is...
Jeff's car.
Yeah, Jeff's car is really dirty, actually. And I drive a pretty filthy car myself.
Sort it out, Jeff.
There's lots of crumbs in that gear stick crevice.
We're still getting emails about GHIC cards. This is from Cleo. When Jane recounted your listeners' concerns about possible fraud enabled by the Easy Access GHIC card, it reminded me of the time I went to Jordan in the early 90s when I was a young teen, exploring this fascinating country, often crisscrossing the Jordan-Israeli border. Our English driver would always confidently wave his Hatfield Polytechnic Library cards at the guards, and every single time he was allowed to drive on, they never challenged it. So I'm very, very interested to hear that, and it just shows you the power of a Hatfield Polytechnic Library card.
That is power.
Yeah, you can go anywhere. Go more, anywhere with that.
More powerful than the Irish driving licence.
Oh, no, we don't want to ignite that one again. Now, hang on, I need to find my fumbling email about... I know we've got to go. About Ireland. Yes, here we go. I was wondering about how Irish people felt about St Patrick's Day. I mean, they have wildly... exceeded all expectations on St. Paddy's Day. Jane asked for Irish opinions on people, they nearly are always Americans, claiming to be from the Republic of Ireland. Whilst mildly irritating, overall, I find it pleasurable, and it's a privilege to be met with joy when somebody finds out your nationality. My English mother is not as lucky in this respect, and notes the change in reaction when she shares that she's lived in Ireland for over 35 years. Is St. Patrick's Day a highly commercialised event based on high consumption of alcohol, and is that slightly embarrassing? Yes. Is there any other country in the world whose national day is celebrated worldwide? Not that I'm aware of. I'll take the slight embarrassment for the grins, hugs and stories that come my way once my Irishness has been revealed. And that is from Jenny. Well, congratulations, Jenny. And I think that's a very measured response. And she's right. No other country's national day is in any way celebrated like St. Patrick's Day. So that's a triumph, isn't it?
It is.
Can you think of another country that we go?
No, I was just trying to think, because quite often we're a bit blinkered, aren't we? Because, you know, we base quite a lot of statements on simply not looking any further than the middle of the globe. But no, I've never...
We mustn't get parochial. Not on a day where the big story here is that Princess Kate's been to a farm shop. Right. Keep your thoughts coming. It's Jane and Fee at Times.radio. We all love a farm shop, by the way.
We really love a farm shop. But my first thought, because they're both carrying quite heavy plastic bags full of goodies, I did think you should have taken your own bag, actually. It's not great. Maybe a Jane and Fee tote bag next time. And then...
Tell you what, if we could arrange that, that would be fabulous.
You're probably 250 quid down. Because quite often a farm shop, you'll just buy a small piece of artisanal cheese.
£95, please.
Unpasteurised. You'll find yourself buying a very odd pickle that just seems to appeal at the time. Some local scented candles and some homemade biscuits. And you are. You're £55 out of pocket. I know they can afford it.
They probably can.
It was quite a haul. But I'm with her. If you're convalescing at home, a little trip out to a farm shop, bingo.
Thank you, our royal correspondent. I did mention, I keep saying we're going to finish, but we've just got one more funny email. This did make me laugh. We mentioned the other day that the BBC said there was no news to broadcast.
Oh, yes, and it's been verified.
Yes, it has been verified. Thank you for the person who verified it. But this is from Andrew, who says, years ago, I lived and worked on a small Caribbean island which had a local radio station. Each lunchtime, they relayed the World Service news. That was the news from London. Local news was then given, followed by island obituaries. On one memorable occasion, the announcer said, "We regret to announce that there are no deaths today." Thank you very much. That is from Andrew, who says he's 81 and can still remember being spellbound when listening to Children's Hour. And the clarity and the diction of all the programmes now continued by Jane and Fee.
Oh, well, that is a lovely thing.
That's
to
a proper
say.
Compliment, Andrew, and thank you for that.
Yeah.
Because clear enunciation, I mean, I'm not always the best at it, but it is beautiful when it's done, isn't it?
It is. It's marvellous. And with that, we say farewell to our listeners from around the globe. We look forward to joining you at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well done for getting to the end of another episode of Off Air with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Our Times Radio producer is Rosie Cutler and the podcast executive producer is Henry Tribe.
And don't forget, there is even more of us every afternoon on Times Radio. It's Monday to Thursday, 3 till 5. You can pop us on when you're pottering around the house or heading out in the car on the school run.
Or running a bank. Thank you for joining us and we hope you can join us again on Off Air very soon.
Don't be so silly. Running a bank.
I know, ladies.
A lady listener.
I'm sorry.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.